Chapter 76. Reacher ran straight for the helicopter. It was 60 yards away, large and white and luminous in the city's nighttime glow. Nagley jogged at his side patiently. Reacher was no kind of a sprinter. He was slow and heavy, and he had stuff bouncing around in his pockets. Any college athlete would have done the 60 yards in 6 or 7 seconds. Nagley would have done it in 8. Reacher took closer to 15. But he got there, in the end. He got there just as the main building's door burst open and light and men spilled out. He dodged left and kept the chopper between him and them. Nagley crowded in at his elbow. 3 guys were heading for the parking lot, fast and urgent. Parker and Lennox and Lamazon. They were all hurrying. For every yard they covered, Reacher and Nagley moved a corresponding inch around the bell, clockwise, touching its belly lightly with their fingertips, using its bulk as a shield. It was cold and dewed over with night mist like a car parked on the street. It felt slimy. It smelled of oil and kerosene. 30 yards away, 3 Chryslers started up. 3 V8 engines, suddenly loud in the stillness. 3 transmissions slammed into gear, 3 pairs of headlights flicked on. They were unbelievably bright in the darkness. They were crisp, focused, hard-edged, and super white. Then they got worse. One by one, they switched to high beam. New lenses lit up. Huge cones of dazzling light swayed and bounced as the cars began to move. Reacher and Nagley slid around the bell's long pointed nose and hugged the other flank. The cars separated like a shell burst and accelerated and headed off in random, changing directions. Within 10 seconds, they had found all 4 dead guys. The cars slewed to a stop at the 2 sites, 50 yards apart. 1 car where Nagley had been, 2 where Reacher had been. Their lights went still, and threw long, grotesque, quadruple shadows off the 4 humped shapes. 3 distant figures ran around, flashing instantly from extreme brightness into total darkness as they moved through the beams.
"We can't stay here," Nagley said. "They're going to come back this way and light us up like we're on stage at the Hollywood Bowl."
"How long have we got?"
"They're going to check the fence pretty thoroughly. 4 minutes, maybe."
"Start counting," Reacher said. He pushed off the helicopter's flank and ran for the main building. 40 yards. 10 seconds. The door had been left ajar. Lights had been left on. Reacher paused. Then he walked straight in, very quietly, with his hand on his Glock in his pocket. Saw nobody inside. The place seemed to be deserted. There were small, walled-off offices on the right, and a big, open-plan work area on the left, behind a floor-to-ceiling plate-glass screen. The work area had long laboratory benches and bright lights and complex extraction ducts on the ceiling to control dust and a grounded metal grid on the floor to control static electricity. A sliding door in the screen was open. The air coming out smelled of warm silicon boards, like a brand-new TV. The offices on the right were little more than 8x8 cubicles with head-high walls and doors. One was labeled Edward Dean, the development engineer, now the quality control guy. The next door was labeled Margaret Berenson, the dragon lady, a remote facility, Reacher guessed, for when she had to deal with human resources issues without dragging assembly personnel all the way south to the glass cube in East L.A. The next door was Tony Swan's. Same principle. 2 centers, 2 offices. The next door was Alan Lamazon's. It was standing open. Reacher took a breath, took his Glock out of his pocket, stepped into the doorway, stood still, saw an 8x8 cube. Desk, chair, fabric walls, phones, file cabinets, stacks of papers, memos. Nothing unusual or out of place, except for Curtis Mawney behind the desk, and a suitcase standing against a wall. Nagley stepped into the room.
60 seconds gone, she said.
Mawney just sat there at the desk, immobile, some kind of blank resignation on his face,
like a man with a bad diagnosis waiting for a second opinion he knows will be no better. His hands were empty. They were curled together on the desktop, like mating crabs. "Lamazan was my partner," he said, like an excuse. Reacher nodded. "Loyalty," he said. "It's a bitch, ain't it?" The suitcase was a dark, gray, hard-shell Samsonite, set neatly against the wall beside the end of the desk. Not the biggest thing Reacher had ever seen. Nothing like the giants some people wrestle through the airport. But it wasn't small, either. It wasn't a carry-on. It had plastic stick-on initials in shallow recesses next to the latches. The initials said A.M.
70 seconds gone, Nagley said.
Morney asked, "What are you going to do?"
"With you?" Reacher asked.
"Nothing yet. Relax." Nagley aimed her gun at Morney's face, and Reacher stepped up beside the desk and knelt down and laid the suitcase flat on the carpet. Tried the latches. They were locked. He put his Glock on the floor and jammed the tips of his index fingers under the tips of the latches and braced his thumbs and bunched his shoulders and heaved. Reacher against two thin, pressed metal tongues. No contest. The locks broke instantly. He lifted the lid.
80 seconds gone.
"Payday," Reacher said. The case was full of fancy engraved paper certificates and letters from foreign banks and small suede drawstring bags that felt heavy in his hand.
$65 million,
Nagley said over his shoulder. At a guess.
90 seconds gone.
Reacher turned his head and looked at Marnie and asked, "How much of this is yours?"
"Some of it," Marnie said.
"Not much, I guess." Reacher made neat creases and folded the paperwork and handed it to Nagley. He followed it with the drawstring bags. Nagley slid everything into her pockets. Reacher left the suitcase where it was, flat on the floor, empty, the lid up like a clam. He picked up his gun and stood and turned back to Morney.
"Wrong. None of it is yours."
2 minutes gone,
Nagley said.
"Your friends are here," Morney said.
"I know," Reacher said. "Lamazan was my partner. You told me that already. I'm just saying."
"So do they know you're here?"
"I've been here before," Marnie said.
"Many times. Pick up the phone."
"Or I'll shoot you in the head."
"You will anyway."
"I should," Reacher said. "You gave up 6 of my friends." Marnie nodded.
"I knew how this would end, when we didn't get you at the hospital."
"L.A. traffic," Reacher said. "It can bite you in the ass."
2 minutes 15,
Nagley said.
Morney asked, "Are we making a deal here?"
"Pick up the phone."
"And what?"
"Tell the gate guard to open up exactly 1 minute from now." Morney hesitated. Reacher put the Glock's muzzle against Morney's temple. Morney picked up the phone. Dialed. Reacher listened hard and heard ringtones from the earpiece and the Chrysler's idling 100 yards away on the open ground and a muted bell 40 yards away in the guard shack. The call was answered. Morney said,
"This is Morney. Open the gate 1 minute from now."
Then he hung up. Reacher turned to Nagley.
"Am I your CO?"
"Yes," she said. "You are."
"Then listen up. When the gate opens, we head for our cars and we get out of here as fast as we possibly can."
"And then?"
"We come back later."
"In time?"
Reacher nodded.
"We'll make it in time if we're fast right now. They're already in their cars, so we have to really go for it. You're a lot faster than me, so I'll be behind you, but don't wait for me. Don't even look back. We can't afford to lose a yard, either one of us."
"Understood." 3 minutes gone.
Reacher grabbed Marnie's collar and hauled him to his feet, dragged him out from behind the desk, out of the office, down the hallway into the open area, over to the main doorway, and then a yard outside, into the night.
The smell of wet ash was strong. The three Chryslers were moving again in the distance. They were turning tight circles on the open ground, and their headlights were sweeping random patterns against the fence like searchlights in a prison movie.
"Wait for the starting gun," Reacher said to Nagley.
He watched the gate, saw the guard move in his booth, saw the concertina wire sway, heard the tortured screech of wheels on a metal rail, saw the gate start to move. He put the Glock to Mawnee's temple and pulled the trigger. Mawnee's skull exploded, and Nagley and Reacher took off at full speed, like sprinters out of their blocks. Nagley was ahead after half a step. Reacher stopped dead and watched her go. She flew through the pool of light from the guard hut and dodged like a running back around the end of the moving gate. She raced out to the street, then she was lost to sight. Reacher turned and ran in the opposite direction. 15 seconds later, he was back where he had started, behind the bell's long nose. Chapter 77. Maybe they had seen Nagley go and assumed Reacher was ahead of her, or maybe they had just seen the gate move or heard its sound through their open windows. Certainly they must have heard the gunshot. Possibly they imagined the rest. But they took the bait. They reacted instantly. All three cars braked and maneuvered and turned and accelerated and headed for the street, fishtailing like crazy and spraying huge rooster tails of dirt high in the air. They went out through the gate like stock cars through a turn. Their headlights lit up the street like day. Reacher watched them go. He waited for the night to go dark and quiet again. Then he counted to 10 and moved slowly along the bell's starboard flank. He ignored the cockpit door. He moved right past it and put his hand on the rear door's handle. He tried it. It was unlocked. He glanced over his shoulder at the pilot's hut. No movement there. He eased the handle down. The latch came free. The door opened. It was wide and light and tinny, like a panel van's. Not at all what he was expecting. Not heavy and pneumatic like an airliner's. He held the door 2 feet open and looped around it and climbed inside. Pulled the door after him and paused, and then closed it against the latch with one sudden decisive click. He ducked down and peered out the window and watched the pilot's hut. No reaction. He turned around in a crouch and knelt on the cabin floor in the darkness. From the inside, the bell looked like a swelled-up version of a minivan, a little wider and a little longer than the kind of things soccer moms drove in television commercials. Less boxy, a little more contoured. Narrower at the front, wider at floor level, pinched in a little more at head height. Narrower at the rear. There would have been 7 seats, 2 in the cockpit, 3 in the center row, 2 way in back, except that the center row was missing. The seats were all bulky, high-backed recliners, faced with black leather. They had headrests and arms, captain's chairs. They had safety harnesses. Below the waistline, the bulkheads were lined with black carpet. Above, they were padded with black quilted vinyl. Very corporate, but a little out of date. Least second-hand, Reacher guessed. The whole interior smelled faintly of jet fuel. There was a space behind the rearmost seats. For bags, Reacher guessed. A luggage compartment. Just like a minivan. It wasn't a huge space, but it was big enough. He found the levers and flopped the seat backs forward. Climbed over and sat down on the floor, sideways, with his legs out straight and his back jammed against the side bulkhead. He took the captured cigs out of his waistband and laid them on the floor next to his knees. He leaned forward and held the seat backs upright. They clicked and locked in place. Then he slumped down to test whether he could get low enough to keep his head out of sight. Probably, he thought. He raised his head again. The cabin windows were misted with dew, dark and gray and featureless, like television screens turned off. Nothing was happening outside. Noises were dulled.
Clearly, the carpet and the quilting doubled as soundproofing layers. He waited.